Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Did you ever get a "this is the first day of the rest of your life" speech?
I don't know that I've ever gotten one of those speeches directly, but certainly very familiar with the sort of the platitude of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And how about this? Have you ever heard of Synanon?
No.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, you know, because whenever I hear a sentence like this, you know, a thing that's familiar right away from the time you hear it, I always wonder what the origin of that is. And so I went and looked at this and I expected it to be something, you know, a lot older, I guess, you know, something from history somewhere. And it's actually from this guy. His name's Charles Diedrich. He goes by Chuck. So Chuck Diedrich. And he is a guy that was behind this organization called Synanon, which was kind of created. It was kind of grassroots. It was all about him, but he just sort of came up with this idea for a real problem that existed. And that was, drug addiction. Like, he was a drunk. He had gotten sober through Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the traditional 12 steps. And, they didn't like people who were addicted to drugs at that time in that organization. There was a little bit of worry, I guess, that it might muddy their message, you know, that it was really just for alcoholics. So he decided that he wanted to start this other thing. And it's a super interesting story. And I can't go down the whole rabbit hole, I guess, that I went down over the last couple of days reading about it. But it all came from, you know, after he had gotten sober and he was in AA, he went to a study, and he did it for money because he was kind of broke, and he was given LSD as a treatment for alcoholism. And he had this really profound experience, and it sort of put him on a path, I guess you could say. And so he created this thing, and it just started out in his apartment. They moved to different places over time in California, and it got pretty big. And I guess it's one of the pioneer drug rehab programs, like the ones we think of now. It's kind of like one of the major forerunners of that system. And it kind of went from being like this one place where people came and they would come and they would dry out, you know, they would get off of the drug, and then they would join this community. And initially it was, you would go there, you would stay for a year or a couple of years or whatever, and then you would graduate, and, you know, through this process you would become a non-addict, I guess. It kind of centered around this kind of thing that he called the game, and it was his own method of getting to the bottom of that. Have you ever heard of any of this kind of stuff?
Yeah, starting to sound a little like a cultish.
Yeah, almost. I mean it definitely gets there. It definitely gets there for sure, and you know, What stood out to me and why I decided to talk about this right now was because I had read about this process, this game, the Synanon game, in relation to something unrelated. It was what seemed unrelated to me whenever I thought about it. There, you know, there's a thing in the U.S. now that's been around for a couple of decades that's pretty popular, and it's about they're like wilderness camps for delinquents. You know, like if you're a parent and you're really worried about your kid and, you know, that their behavior, and you can't sort of get it under control, there are people that will come and take them away and send them to these camps in the wilderness until they can fix them and send them back, you know, essentially. And they use this same kind of what I don't know what else to call it besides, like, attack therapy. You know, they you break the person down. That's sort of the process. So, you know, this whole thing is kind of embedded in a lot of stuff that's out there now that's you know, related to rehab. But like you mentioned, it did get kind of cultish in its original form. It was, you know, it went from being a place where you could go and you could get help to a community that people who weren't even addicts could pay to be a member of, you know, to kind of get into this communal living and get the, you know, get that that therapy. You know, if you, I kind of have to put air quotes around it. I really don't like the idea of the way that sounds. But you know, and then as things got weird, it became like, you know, a psychological program, I guess is what they thought it was. And whenever that started to come under, you know, people started to try to break it apart or try to figure out what was going on there, they became a religion. And then it all kind of fell apart in the 90s when some of the members decided to, there was a lawyer who was going and trying to get people out of this place because their families were saying, like, look, you know, our kids have been abducted by a cult, basically, and they won't let us talk to them. They won't let them leave. You know, this guy went after some of these family members and he won a case. And so his followers, Chuck Diedrich's followers, took a 4-foot long rattlesnake and they removed the rattle so it would be silent, and they put it in his mailbox. So when he reached his hand in there, he got bit and he almost died. And from there, wow, things just evolved. And you know, it doesn't really exist in that name so much anymore. I think there's still one in Germany that carries that name. But I mean, it, you know, a lot of the people who went through there, they're still out there. They went and started their own places. And there's a lot of far reaching sort of ripple effects that came out of this one guy, like he had an idea, you know, he had this idea that was actually something that solved the problem for him personally, you know, in a crisis situation. But then it also happened to be useful to people in the community. I mean, they were raising a lot of money. People were donating a lot of money to try to get it going. And it was pretty big. But then, you know, the moral of the story is that even though he started out with these great intentions, he got a taste for power and he basically became the leader of these people's lives, you know. And it's a little bit different, but I mean, things devolved from there, right? He became you know, a cult leader. And it's a little bit different, but that whole idea of, you know, the having this really, really essential need and something that you make a decision that, you know, goes down and creates this situation. And then you get that taste for power, right? You know, it's kind of like what we see happen with Walt.
Today is the first day of the rest of your life.
What are you doing?
This is the first day of the rest of your life, but what kind of life will it be, huh? Will it be a life of fear, of, oh, no, 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 I can't do this, of never once believing in yourself?
Welcome to Growth, Decay, Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Courtney.
And we're joined by producer Talitha. Today we're going to be talking about the season one finale, a no rough stuff type deal, which borrows a line from the Coen brothers' 1996 film Fargo. It's also the only season finale to not be written by Vince Gilligan. There's one other exception, which is the mid-season finale of season 5, but that's a little bit of a different situation. And Courtney, could you give us a nice little synopsis about what happens in this episode?
Of course. So this episode begins at JP Wynn with a briefing on the stolen lab equipment as APD vows to continue their search for the person responsible for stealing the equipment from Walt's lab. Walt starts feeling Skyler up under the table.
They're a little frisky.
Yeah. They then go outside and they rock that Aztec in the school parking lot. And we see that Jesse gets out of the hospital and he's put his house up for sale. So he's recovering in the RV. And they get back to cooking, but they're only able to produce half a pound. And Tuco, this obviously upsets Tuco, and he reprimands them for wasting his time, to which Walt responds by doing what he promises him, 4 pounds. Yeah. So, you know, production problems. He hasn't considered that they need pseudo. And meanwhile, Skylar has her baby shower. And she is gifted a white gold baby tiara by Marie. So, of course, she wants to go and return that because who needs a white gold baby tiara? And when yeah, well, she goes to
Can we interrupt this? Can I interrupt you for a second? Like, when does a baby wear the tiara?
I guess for her debut. I don't know.
Yeah, this is something that's always stood out to me. Like, I guess for a photo, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's not something
maybe
you wear in the crib.
No. It would be like maybe at like a christening or something, or like a first birthday. I don't know, like some special event, I guess.
Yeah.
I can't really see the need for it. Maybe someone out there has bought a tiara for their baby and they could let us know. when do you use a baby tiara? Okay, so yeah, so she of course wants to return this tiara, and she is accused of stealing the tiara, and she feigns labor to get out of that situation. So with not enough pseudo to make good on their promise to Tuco, Walt and Jesse decide that they're going to go to a P2P cook, and they need to steal some methylamine in order to do that. So Walt lies to Skylar, which he's getting better at doing, and tells her that he's going to be going to a sweat lodge, and instead heads out to the desert with Jesse to cook. And when they meet up with Tuco in the junkyard at the end, Tuco samples some of the blue stuff. And I think at this point in the series, we're learning the effect that meth has on Tuco. And poor Nodos makes the grave mistake of daring to speak for him.
Bad choice.
So, yeah, definitely a bad choice. A very rough stuff type deal goes down.
Yeah.
So Pete, what did you think about this one?
I mean, I guess the thing about this episode on rewatch is that it looks and feels like exactly what it is. It's a regular episode of a season that was cut short because of the writer's strike, which we can get into that in a little bit. But it was modified slightly to turn it into a finale, but it doesn't come off as one, really, I think. There are some real gems in the dialogue and some foundational character stuff that happens, and it's just sort of like following up on the last episode's confrontation at Tuco's office. It feels like it's a bit of a step back to set up the next part of the story rather than a climax, like a natural ending to this first season. But still, it's a solid episode. The inclusion of him wanting all the money in the situation where he can't even deliver what he promised this time, and then paying that off by the end of the episode, shows just how dangerous Tuco is and how the decisions they make have consequences. That all works well, and it leaves the viewer wanting more. And I think that's pretty effective. And, you know, plus this is the first time we see the blue meth and the pork pie hat. So there's a lot that's good here. And I know both of us, we watched this, not week to week in the first season, so we didn't really have that experience of like having to wait for the next season to come out or whatever. But I think, yeah, I think that you could say that they did what they could do with a unique situation. And like I said, we can talk about the strike and some of the effects that come from that later, but it probably ended up being good for the show in the long run. So what about you? What did you think?
Yeah, I largely agree with your impressions as well. So this was a decent finale for something that wasn't intended to be a finale, because it ends something on like a high note for them. They're finally starting to make some progress and things are really starting to look up for them after we've just seen, like, you know, everything that they've gone through to get to this point. There's finally this opportunity for growth, to actually, you know, get this thing off the ground and be successful at it. I think, though, the most interesting parts of this episode are the glimpses that we get into how some of the other characters think about crime and how all of them are willing to break the law to some degree. And the cliffhanger at the end, if you can even call it that, I think just really reinforces what we already know. Tuco is highly unstable and unpredictable. And when you add meth into that equation, he becomes extremely volatile, right? So the title, as a nod to Fargo, as you noted, I think casts Walt into the same role as the character that William H. Macy plays, Jerry Lundegaard, who's this very naive middle-class family man who decides to break bad. And they both think that they can control the situation, that they can enter into this life of crime, or maybe they don't even think of it as entering into a life of crime. They're just going to have this little foray into crime. Like, they're going to be able to keep their neat little tidy life separate. And there won't be any violence or fallout from it, right? So Walt's entering into this business relationship with Tuco, knowing full well what he is capable of, you know, what he did to Jesse. But yeah, he still somehow thinks it's going to be okay. And it's, he, you know, leaves me scratching my head a little bit. Like, if you play with matches, you're going to get burned, right?
Yeah. And I do like the comparison with Jerry from Fargo. Because does intention matter, really? Or is that just something that we tell ourselves? You know, because the whole idea of a no rough stuff type deal, I mean, does he think that people go out and order the rough stuff type deal? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of funny because it pulls together a lot of the ideas of what's happening here. And, you know, and you just touched on some of them. And you know, Jesse does, he kind of points this out later, is, you know, they're not criminals. They don't really understand what's necessary. They just have a problem that they're trying to solve, and they want to use this particular route. But I guess the question then is, as we look at things and the way that they make their decisions, does that imply that they believe that, you know, criminals are doing things in a way that is somehow disconnected? I guess, yeah, just to bring it back to that, does the intention matter? Does that really matter?
Well, I think this is something that the show explores really well, this universe explores, and like the biases and preconceptions that people have. We talked a little bit about this already with like Hank and like some of the prejudices that he holds. But there, it seems to be somewhat like a universal belief that is shared by people like Walt, like Jerry, who's played by William H. Macy in Fargo, that a criminal has a certain look and they behave a certain way. And the scene that you're referencing later with Jesse is when they're in the junkyard. That was Walt's choice to meet in a junkyard to do this deal with Tuco. And Jesse's like, couldn't we meet at like Taco Cabeza or the mall or something? And I love how
nobody ever gets shot at Taco Cabeza.
And when Tuco arrives, he has the same question, like, was the mall closed or something? So yeah. Kind of like calling out this like absurd idea of meeting there. So like Walt has this idea of what a criminal looks like. And that's one of the things that really, as I was saying, really stood out to me in this episode, is like how each of these characters think about crime, because you see a lot of moralizing happen throughout the series, but also with characters like specifically Hank and Marie, and even Skylar and Walt, like their ideas of like what is legal, what is illegal. And I think that's something that this episode explores really well. But it's most obvious, I think, perhaps with Walt, but this idea of where that line is between legal and illegal, or how does Hank phrase it? When he's holding the Cuban cigar, like the forbidden fruits. And certainly Skylar, when they're having sex in the back of the Aztec at the beginning of the episode, you know, she's willing to break the law a little bit. And she's like, why was it so damn good? And he said, because it was illegal, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't forget your pants. We'll be right back after this short break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more growth, decay, and transformation.
Yeah, and there's a pretty direct line through the entire episode that follows that. Like you said, that whole idea of sometimes forbidden fruit tastes the best. That's okay for a guy like Hank, you know, because you know he sees himself as someone who's doing more good than bad. That he's on the right side of things. That he is the kind of person that you should aspire to be. And so, you know, a little bit of forbidden fruit, who's that hurting? You know, what is that? What's the downside of that? On the other hand, these other people, these criminals, these people that are, you know, in this different category, somehow they're not able to enjoy that forbidden fruit in the same way. It's going to have a different effect on them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, when I was talking about like this universal idea, I think what I was really trying to say is like the archetype, right? Like the archetype mm-hmm. of what a criminal is and how they behave and how tightly so many of these characters cling to those ideas and fail to see like their own complicity in crime, right? Like they cannot think of themselves as criminals. And that's something we see Walt wrestle with throughout the series. I know I'm jumping way ahead into the future, but there's this one scene with Walt and Jesse when Jesse's sort of come to terms with what they've done. And he says, you know, I'm the bad guy. And like Walt can still not reconcile like that idea of himself as being a criminal with, you know, what they've done.
And neither can other people, right? Because in the very beginning, they're talking about all, you know, there's all these, you know, parents at this meeting in the school, and they're all talking about like the horrors of like, how are we going to fix this? You know, bad stuff is happening at the school. It's all out of their control. There's these evil forces at play or whatever. And he's sitting right there.
Yeah.
Walt's sitting right there, and nobody is like looking into him as a potential, you know, suspect. And of course, that's the reason why he gets away with what he gets away with for so long, because he doesn't fit into that category. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So again, like these ideas that people hold on to. We've already spoken a lot about how Hank specifically perceives Walt and why it takes him so long to really figure it out, because he just, yeah, it's not even on his, like, within his realm of like possibilities that it could be someone like Walt. And speaking of that scene, right, watching that scene again and watching it closely, and this is something I mentioned to you off air, you know, rewatching this episode again, and I've seen it several times, but studying it closely to be able to talk about it, you know, for the podcast, I was really repulsed by that scene and repulsed by Walt in a way that I don't know that I was previously this early into the series, certainly by the end of the series, yes. But I don't know. I don't know if it was just because I'm just, I know where it's going, or looking at how like grotesque it is. And thinking again, because of our conversation last week about poor Hugo, right? And like, that's they're talking about Hugo as he's like getting like turned on as he's filling up Skylar. And one of the guys in the meeting mentions like, didn't we catch the guy, and et cetera, et cetera. And like, I don't know. It's just that Walt is capable of being aroused at that moment. It's kind of creepy, right? And
yeah,
and I wanted to ask you this question because it's something that, because right after, I think it's the scene right after that, they go to the doctor. Dr. Del Cavoli is the next cut. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about like Skylar's asking about holistic medicine, Eastern medicine, stuff like that, if there's any benefit. And he said, if it offers a, you know, my patients a positive outlook, you know, I'm all for it, because a positive outlook can be very healing. And I was thinking about that in context of like where Walt is finding his joy, you know, sort of like he's turned on, he's more frisky, and crime to him is an aphrodisiac. And this is something that if you watch Better Call Saul, you also see for for Kim and for Jimmy, mm-hmm. you know, Breaking Bad in their own way is also, you know, an aphrodisiac. They feel empowered or turned on by it. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, do you think that he has a positive outlook? Like, would you frame it in that way? Like being able to get away with what he's getting away with, is that where he is finding his joy? Is that the positive outlook that actually helps him, you know, to heal?
Yeah, I think that from what we know about him, and if we only think about what we know about him going into this episode, I think it sort of leans in the direction of him being validated for being smarter than everyone else, kind of thing. Like, you know, if you think about like where he was and where his setbacks and his regrets are, is that he didn't really make something out of himself. He ended up being the teacher instead. I think that probably the thing that would make him the most satisfied is that kind of pulling shit off and then being like, yeah, this shows that I am actually the smartest person in the room, kind of thing. And I think there's a little bit of that in the way this plays out, because when you were talking about just kind of how gross it is, and how it didn't really hit that way the first time. And the first, I guess, you know, when you first are watching this, you're thinking, oh, wow, you know, Walt's getting a little bit crazy. You know, that's fun. But yeah, when you put everything together, he can't be bothered to hear about this guy that just last week he was feeling bad about, you know, that this stuff happened to Hugo. At this point, it's just like, I can't really even, you know, I'm not even really, I can't even pay attention to this, what's happening here. It's all kind of beneath me. And I think like I think that is there, him getting away with it is turning him on. And that definitely feeds right into him saying the reason why she thought it was so good is because it's illegal. But I hadn't picked up on that before. So I guess maybe that is something that they're introducing here, alongside the idea that everybody commits crimes, even the people who consider themselves to be above it all, you know, and they all look at things in different ways that just make it so whatever they're doing is okay.
Yeah, and I think It also, but I guess what I was thinking in terms of is like, so like, yes, Walt is getting off on all of this for all the things you just laid out. So he's getting away with things. He's feeling validated and powerful, but it's not going to be enough for him, right? Like he's going to eventually need more and more and more and more. And he's going to want recognition, right? So like certainly like further down into the story when he is, he basically puts Hank back onto investigating who Heisenberg is after he thinks it might be Gail Bedecker, right? Like, because he can't stand someone else getting credit for his work. And we also see that happen when Saul sets up the zombie accounts to donate to Junior's PayPal or whatever. Mm-hmm. We see also like the idea of him not getting credit is really like for him.
I think it does. It ties into what we started off this part with, and about the idea of does intention matter. It to a certain extent, I guess. But when you get into this world, into this thing where you certainly have a measure of power that you didn't have before, and that there's a real, you know, there's a real chance at exponential kind of growth, and you know, you can really take that and turn it into something where you couldn't in your previous situation. Yeah, I mean, the intention only goes so far, because people are just bound to get caught up in that, and that's really the reason why most of the stuff that, you know, the other people overlook. And you can kind of maybe use the example of Marie about how, you know, she's kind of escalating in her thing with, like, you kind of get the sense in the whenever she gets together with, when Skylar tracks her down after the incident with the tiara, you kind of get the sense that Marie just kind of spends all day going around shoplifting, because that's where she gets her buzz, right?
Yeah, you definitely do. Like, so, but it's also with Marie. Well, the first time we see her do it is stealing the high heels, right? And it's almost like she's doing that out to spite the girl for asking her to put on the footies. And
yeah, then that's stealing, what I'm saying. And by this point, that's not like that at all anymore. Like, she's just rolling around this, you know, like right before Skylar arrives in that scene, she picks up some.
Earrings,
and you kind of think that those are going to go with her at the end of this if she doesn't get, right? I mean, was that the way you looked at it?
I don't know that she would have stolen those. I mean, I guess it's certainly a possibility, because the narrative around her kleptomania changes a little bit, and we see like later it becomes like a coping mechanism for her when she's like going to the open houses and stealing, like, you know, things that she wouldn't necessarily like need, like, or even want. Like, who cares about a spoon or a picture frame? It's almost like it's a, like a compulsive thing, right? Like stealing shoes, stealing earrings. Like, you can understand why people might want to steal those things, because they want them, they can't afford them. Yeah, certainly, it looks like she can afford whatever she wants, but stealing those other things. So there's like a change in what she's stealing and why she seems to be stealing.
She did it for what she thought was a justified reason in the beginning, but then it gets away from her at some point.
Yeah. So this is the second instance we've seen after the high heels, and this was a gift, right? She wanted to get something nice for her niece. And I love how that's tied back the question that Walt pitches to Skylar when he comes back from his, you know, his sweat lodge, aka like really cooking in the desert with Jesse, and she's telling him the story about what happened, and he says, "What would you do if it was me?" It's almost like he's testing to see how would she. Of course, it's not that. It seems he is actually testing to see how she might react to that situation. What are her thoughts on that? And he says, sometimes people do things for their families. It's almost like he's starting to rationalize and extend that rationalization to someone like Marie. Like, if it's okay if Marie does it, it'll be okay if, you know, I cook meth for my family.
I want to come back to that, because there's a couple other things there, because I think that is the majority of what's interesting about this episode, is the way that all kind of comes together at the end. And there was one thing I wanted to ask about earlier in the, before we get there, And it's about whenever Walt comes over to the house, the real estate agent is showing it, and she sends him into the, she tells him that Jesse's in the RV, right? So there's a quick exchange there where he said, "You didn't really go to see Tuco, right?" And, you know, he can't believe it when he shows him the money. And, like, think about that from, like, do you think Walt considered even briefly the effect that, like, working with Tuco might have on his partner? I mean, he's still there wrapped up, like, his he had broken ribs, I think Skinny Pete said in the last episode. He's still laid up and everything else. Like, it's pretty, I mean, if you're in a partnership with someone, that's a pretty crazy thing to do, isn't it?
I mean, not consider how he might feel about that situation.
About the guy who put him in the hospital, like working on an ongoing basis with the guy who's working in the hospital.
I don't think Walt is really capable of really considering how other people feel at any given time. Yeah,
I guess that's what I was getting at. Is that what that is telling us, that he's not capable of it, or he just overlooked it because he needs this thing so much? You know, he needs this money and he doesn't know any other distributors besides Tuco.
Yeah, I think that's probably, and maybe it's not that he doesn't care about other people's feelings. That's just not like what's at the forefront of his mind. Again, we've been talking a lot about the kind of thinking that he does. Mm-hmm. And so he thinks in terms of, like, you know, a more logical, right? Like, I need this. This is a problem that can be solved. But again, like, it's delusional, right? Like, he sees what would happen, but he thinks somehow it's going to be different when he does this. Like, it's going to be okay, because I guess he feels like he has the upper hand in this relationship because of what happened with the fulminated mercury. Like, he made his point. He still doesn't seem to understand just how dangerous this person is. And I think that speaks more to his naivete than anything, than it does, like, maybe disregarding Jesse's feelings. Like, I think he really thinks he's going to be able to go into this and it's going to be, like, a perfect, happy transaction. You know, it kind of reminds me of in Better Call Saul. Remember Price? Who makes the deals with Nacho, and just how completely and utterly naive that dude is going into dealing with a member of the cartel. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I was just thinking about that when I watched it this time. I was thinking about how just crosses such a huge line as far as partnership, you know, like, yeah, I know the guy beat you down and, you know, you were almost, you were like basically in a coma for a couple of days, you know, didn't wake up, but I took care of it and don't worry, it's not going to come back. Like, I mean, there's real trauma involved in that beat down, right? I mean, it's not just a small thing that happened that you can say, yeah, you know, he was in a bad mood that day or something like that.
Yeah, no, there's definitely real trauma, and this is, you know, certainly a precursor of things to come when it comes to Walt and Jesse and how he completely disregards Jesse's feelings about everything. So certainly Jane comes to mind, but there are other, you know, things along the way where he does not take into consideration how things are going to affect him. So another thing that comes to mind, more serious, right? So certainly Jane, but when he instructs him to go and get his money back from Spooge when he gets robbed by, where was it, Skinny Pete that gets robbed by Spooge and he wants him to go and collect the money. So he puts Jesse on that business, where that's a really traumatic event for Jesse. And then of course what happens with Gail as well. Although in that case, that's a little bit different because it was kind of a either kill or be killed situation. But yeah, he does not really seem to take Jesse's feelings into consideration at all.
And now that Tuco has entered the situation, I mean, on one hand, that's a good development for us, because it, you know, they had plenty of time to develop these two characters and give us an idea of what makes them tick. And now they have, you know, there's a definite build up in the momentum that a character like Tuco brings into the story. He's not as easy to, you know, like he's an immovable force, and they're in bed with him now, and that, you know, you just can tell, even if you don't know what's going to happen, like that this is going to change the way that that's, you know, the change the direction of where things are going, right?
Yeah, he's completely erratic and unpredictable. So again, Walt wants everything to be neat and predictable, but this guy is unstable as it is. And then you give him drugs and he's even more unstable. And he's such a great character in terms of just like, I love how Raymond Cruz plays him. He's interesting and compelling to watch. You've seen Goodfellas, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you remember Joe Pesci when he gets upset when the guy calls him funny, and he's like, "What am I, a clown? Am I here to amuse you?" And he goes off on him. That's the kind of energy that Tuco brings to Breaking Bad.
He definitely does. So I guess let's take a little side trip here, because I don't even know where to start with it, though, because so Raymond Cruz was pegged to be the big bad. He was there to be this guy that would cause problems for Walt, to be his antagonist, I guess. He was also on another show called The Closer, and he had obligations there. So his time on the show ended up getting cut shorter than they would have originally done. What do you think about, like, let's just get into the whole thing with this writer's strike and the way that this whole thing sort of changed. All right. So initially, when Breaking Bad was bought, after they bought the pilot and they put it to order for, there was, it's going to be a 9-episode season, and then this writer's strike happened and they had to cut it to 7. That's why this feels a little bit truncated and not like a true finale, because the way that worked, I guess, is that they had what they had completed, and then they had to adapt without the writers being on staff, right? Is that a good estimation of how that played out?
I think so. That's my understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting in general. I mean, the writer's strike, it was the first one that it started in 2007. It was the first one they had since the 80s. And back whenever in the 1980s, whenever they did this, and I'm just doing this, I'm not going to go into all the details of it, just a general outline of what happened. When they did that back then, there was a lot of questions about residuals around this new thing, which was VHS tapes, video stores, which were kind of the precursor to streaming TV, I guess. If you wanted to watch something, you would go to the VHS store or whatever, and you could rent it on demand that way. And that changed things, obviously, for how people got paid, because they had to produce these, they had to sell them, and then they would, they would make the money that way rather than through advertisement on network TV when they showed the shows or whatever, in syndication or however that happened. So so they changed things up, and then over that 20 years in between, the price of making those videotapes and stuff went down a lot, and they needed to renegotiate the idea of how much of a percentage they should get based on that, the writers. And also streaming was starting to come up, and that was basically the Wild West, because it wasn't stipulated how they would get paid for stuff that they would just show on a subscription service that could, that wasn't really giving them information about how many times people were watching it or any of that kind of stuff. So it was something that needed to happen. It was a pretty good, I'm sure for the writers, it was very good as far as making sure that they were getting as fair a deal as possible. But yeah, so we got this short season, and we do know from interviews and things like what they would have done instead, because they did actually write 9 episodes, right? And it was ready to go. And so we know that Tuco was going to come in and he was going to really kind of cause some problems by the end of the first season. Like there were two different scenarios that they had that they were working with going into the finale that both got cut. And
to kill Jesse and the other was it Steve Gomez? Is that right?
Well, the Jesse thing they changed the Jesse thing much earlier. That was like,
three or four, right? They decided they needed to keep him.
Yeah, like the thing with Jesse, and that's something that you hear, that the writer's strike saved Jesse, but that's not really true. That's kind of just sort of the way the story got passed down. According to what Vince Gilligan said after the series was complete, when he wrote the pilot, he had the idea that he was going to kill Jesse. But then, you know, that's the only thing they filmed, and then they had to shop it around, it got bought. But by the time they got into the writer's room, they already kind of had a sense that they wanted to keep Aaron Paul around. And when they started to break the other episodes, they realized that would be really effective to have these two characters that you could sort of have parallel each other. Whereas Jesse's reason originally that he put him in the pilot was to get him an introduction into the criminal underworld, which he had already served that purpose by, you know, the end there. So yeah, that saved him. But the two ideas they had going into the finale, and we touched on this in an earlier episode, so sorry about that, but it's kind of relevant here. And so the what they said was that Gomez was going to get shot. You know, Tuco was going to shoot Steve Gomez, Hank's partner, and Walt was going to come up and he wouldn't know what to do, but Gomez would see him, you know, and he would get covered with his blood, and he would basically season two would have, like, you would have had the cliffhanger at the end of the season where you don't know if he's going to live. And if he does live, then what he's going to do, because he's identified that Walt is connected to Tuco in some way, which is a big problem. Right. And so season one was going to end with him going down an alley covered in blood, running, you know, with Gomez's blood and sirens going off, and you thinking, oh, how's he going to get out of this? So that was the one. And then the other one was that Tuco was going to break into their house, like a home invasion, to steal their money, steal Walt's drug money. And Skyler and Walt Jr. were going to be there. They were going to be like duct taped and waiting for Walt to come home. And you know, Tuco would be saying, like, you know, give me the money or I'm going to kill your family or whatever. And Skyler would be like, this is crazy. You have no idea. Well, like, what are you doing here? You know, like, my husband doesn't know what you're talking about or whatever. And then he would have to go get the money and it would come out in front of his family that, like, what he was doing. So it's both of those have very different implications on what the series would be afterwards.
Yeah, it definitely would. And it's fun to, like, as like a thought experiment to think of, like, how the series would have gone had they gone that way. I'm sure that they would have made it work, but I'm so glad it didn't work out that way. Cause I just love how the story does go.
Yeah. I mean, cause if you think about it, those two options, it's either one that an active DEA agent knows that Walt's involved with Tuco, or two, that his family know that he's some kind of drug kingpin that has a bunch of money that this guy just came into their house and stole.
Yeah.
You know? So you know, I think that they've all been, the writers and the creators have all been pretty, have said it more than once, you know, they thought that this gave them a chance to slow down, and it really, mm-hmm. it really made the story, because, you know, the I guess the thinking going into it was like, you know, this is our first season, we don't know if we're going to get another one, so we just have to throw everything at this finale, yeah. and make it as crazy as possible. And so it just didn't get to happen that way, because it just, I mean, they literally wrote these, you know, ideas out and you got it ready to go. But then the season got cut short and they just had to end it here based on necessity. So it's pretty wild when you think about it like that.
Yeah, it is. I was going to say it probably would have been a much shorter show had they gone the way that they had intended to. Okay, I was just thinking about the pacing in some of the other episodes as well. So, and this is, you know, probably most people out there have heard this story because it's one of the more well-known, I think, stories about Breaking Bad, because it's something that gets talked about a lot, both by Bryan Cranston and Vince Gilligan. But the scene where he watches Jane die was originally written so that, like, he pushed her on her back. Yeah. Or, like, they even had, I think, they had floated the idea that he gave her the hot shot. But I think it was the executives, actually, that came back and they're like, are you sure you want him to go this far this soon? Because he was more involved in actively pushing her over and her dying, as opposed to what they ended up doing, where it was like an accident that he's shaking Jesse and he bumps into her and she rolls over on her back. And, you know, that's something that Vince has talked about, how grateful he is that they slowed things down a little bit instead of taking it to those extremes. So it is interesting to think, like, had his family known this early, or had, you know, DEA agents known this early, like, how would that have expedited the character arc and the story in terms of,
because,
like, development of this character into what he devolves into?
Yeah, it's a great point, because, like you said, I've heard that same story about the note and the idea that maybe, you know, they needed to make that the whole Jane situation a little more up to interpretation, because that way, you know, people wouldn't turn on Walt. I mean, if Gomez knew, and that's where they were starting from there, then we're going to have to see them take care of Gomi. And that really is going to change the way a lot of people view Walt, I think. It would be a lot harder to, you know, stay behind him and say, like, okay, well, I can, it's harder to explain away than a lot of the other stuff that actually happens in the series. Right.
Yeah. Well, certainly at this point too, right. Because it would then become a problem that needs to be solved to further, you know, protect himself. Right. Where it's like one thing to kill Crazy Eight, which we talked a lot about, like, you know, like that was premeditated murder, right? So there is a shift there from killing Emilio, which was self-defense, to intentionally killing Crazy Eight, again, for his own self-interest. And you can argue, you can look at the morals of that decision in finer detail. But to kill a DEA agent is like a completely different animal, right?
Yeah, that was my point. So, yeah, I mean, that's all pretty fascinating stuff. Glad it worked out the way it did. I don't know. I guess the whole reason I brought this up was I was wondering what you thought about Tuco, about his stay being short. How you think about that? I mean, obviously that gives rise to Gus eventually. You know, they had to replace him, which is obviously, in my opinion anyways, an upgrade. You know, Tuco's great for what he is, but I'm not sure if I want to watch four seasons of that. Do you want to watch four seasons of that?
Again, it's one of those things that's hard to say. I'm glad that it worked out the way it did, because, I mean, we got to meet Gus and we got to see Gus. And I think of all these, like, these sort of these what things ifs that happened. Yeah, these what ifs, but also, like, the things that happened that led to the creation of new characters. So, like, for example, Bob Odenkirk not being available to shoot that we've been talking about, the Jesse and Jane scene. He wasn't available to shoot that, so they had to invent Mike to come in and be the cleaner for that. And I think in Better Call Saul, they had something similar with Raymond Cruz, where, like, he didn't want to continue. I think his wife didn't want him to keep playing the character. It was just, like, a hard character for him to play when he reprises his role as Tuco on that show. So that also changed what they had to do in terms of writing. So they'd already mentioned the name Lalo, but his, you know, being out of the picture, getting arrested, allowed for Lalo to come in to, take over the Salamanca family business. And again, a little behind the scenes story there is that Vince Gilligan didn't think they needed to write Lalo. And he was like, yeah, whatever, it's just a throwaway line that we wrote in Breaking Bad, you know, when they first kidnap him and they have him on, I'm talking about Saul, they have Saul on his knees in the desert when Walt and Jesse kidnap him. He's like, no, it wasn't me. It was Ignacio. And Lalo didn't send you, right? So I love that Peter Gould insisted that they do bring in Lalo. So, I mean, they probably would have brought him in anyway, but Raymond Cruz stepping out of Better Call Saul allowed for Lalo to come in. And if you haven't seen Lalo and Better Call Saul, please go watch it. It's so good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think like the, I think both of those, and I guess it just all is to credit the crew and everyone involved in the writer's room and everything else of being able to adapt to the situations and make the best out of it. You know, I'm sure that you have those ideas and they sound incredible and you're ready to go. And then it gets changed and you have to come up with something that is, you know, that works for what you have. Like, I feel like, you know, the Tuco is a great character. And like you said, the performance is great. But I think it kind of would have been a different show if there's a lot of, you know, if it turned out that it was just Walt versus Tuco for an extended period of time. I kind of like how he kind of burns bright and is gone before too long.
It's almost like playing a video game. Like he levels up, like he kills like the first villain. He has to go beat like the next boss. Right. Yeah. So they get the levels get progressively harder.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty literally that when you think about it, except maybe Jack isn't a level up from Gus necessarily, but you know.
No, definitely not.
You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation, and we'll be right back.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcast on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation. Talking about Tuco, you know, I think there were two scenes in this that really kind of that were kind of like notes on the character, you know, like where you really see things of the character that are brought out, you know, and I think the first one is whenever we see him at the baby shower. Junior's got the camcorder, Marie's got him doing all this stuff, and Walt walks by it's set up perfectly because you're watching it through the lens of the camcorder, so you see this weird kind of image that comes from that. You see him kind of get caught by surprise because he's in this uncomfortable situation with all these people inside his house and then, you know, for this party for his wife. And you get a really kind of Walt being what he imagines is his best self in that moment there. Right. He talks about how he thinks about her all the time and he's proud of her and, you know, it's moving. And then, you know, the thing that really drives it is the fact that we know that he knows that he won't be around by the time that she sees the videotape.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about maybe the bigger idea of recordings as artifacts in this series. So we see a couple, they use recordings like videotape in a really interesting way, I think, throughout. So we see in the very first episode in the pilot when he turns Jesse's camera around to record himself and he leaves this like farewell message to his family because he thinks he's about to get caught or he's about to kill himself. I think that was his intention. He puts the gun to his head. And then this here too, again, it's a message that he's leaving behind for his daughter, right, with the expectation that he's not going to be able to see her grow up, right? And I at this moment I think is a nice little companion moment to that earlier scene that we saw in one of the earlier episodes when before Skylar and the family knows that he has cancer, they're at the ultrasound place and
yeah.
You know,
and
she's like, remember that.
Hand.
Yeah. Remember you said that when she turns 16, right? And that sort of really morose look on his face. So, yeah, I still think at this point, he's still kind of expecting to die. And I think he's, as I've already made this point, I think has resigned himself to this idea. So he's just going to throw all caution to the wind and do what he has to do to be able to leave something behind for his family. So this is this little moment that he records for posterity for his child is interesting. It's an interesting look into Walt's mind. And then just a couple of the other examples of where we see him on film, of course, is having to figure out how to destroy the footage from within the lab, after Gus is taken care of, and they want to make sure that they destroy that. And then also the recording that he and Skylar make to try to blackmail Hank at the end, where Walt's confession, right, about how he was forced into doing it. That's I'm sorry to derail the conversation, but you got me thinking about film and recording as artifact in the series.
Yeah, and then one of the funnier scenes in this episode becomes a pretty good videotape in the next episode too. The methylamine heist there.
Oh yeah.
I think it's in Definitely. The next. I haven't watched ahead since we started doing this, but I think I remember there was a point where Hank is watching the tape and they're talking about them, and it's pretty funny.
Yeah, talking about how stupid they are because it rolls.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Which is exactly what I was thinking about whenever I watched this. You know, I was like, why are they carrying it? They could just roll it.
Yep.
But yeah, so the other thing with the other place, I think, where we just really quickly, though, I guess that's connected. There's another connection to this idea of him thinking about the future whenever Jesse says, how long is that? When they're talking about the money once they get the cook going. And, you know, he's just sort of saying, like, you know, you're dying. So how much longer are we going to be making this weekly money or something like that? But yeah, the other moment, I think, which is a big one character wise, is that whenever he doesn't have the goods. He only has a half pound when he's supposed to have two. Tuco is, you know, understandably upset with him for that. And he tells him he wants the money anyways. And it's one of those moments where you're like, why did you do that? Like, nobody can understand. Like, nobody watching, especially Jesse, he's kind of our stand in there inside the scene to say, like, why would you do that? Why would anyone do this?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is, we saw this in the last episode with Jesse as well. With just like when they're having that conversation about trying to find a distributor, and just like, well, just not understanding at all how it works, and making these promises that at the time Jesse hasn't figured out, like, how they're going to be able to do this because they've been using Pseudo. But of course Walt always has answers, doesn't he? So he sort of clumsily fumbles his way through things, and he has an incredible amount of luck. Right.
Yeah.
And really, I guess it is his ability, his science, right? His intellect that ultimately always pulls them out of the fire.
Yeah. So I think that was one of the, when I watched it the first time and when I rewatch it every time, I think that's one of those moments where the character does something. It makes sense. You know, based on a situation or whatever, but it's really kind of like, wow, why did he do that? Why would he, this guy's obviously dangerous. This is obviously something he couldn't do last time. Why would he up the ante? Why would he put him and, you know, essentially his family at risk, by making, you know, taking that money at that moment? But well, it also worked.
He's also a man. I mean, if he thinks he's going to die, he feels like he's got nothing left to lose. And he's riding this like high right now where he feels like he's getting away with everything. He, you know, is outsmarting everyone. He's outsmarting his brother-in-law, who's always sort of looked down on him. He's outsmarting the school, the police, the DEA. He outsmarted Tuco, right? Like, so he's really feeling himself at the moment. And yeah, of course that's like the biggest problem with Walt. And that's what his, you know, undoing is this out of control ego. And we're starting to see that develop here, I think.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was going, because I think you really, one scene that I didn't really remember standing out as much as it did, you know, when I watched it this time, was when he comes home from the cook and she's there and they talk about it. It's I'll bring this back up in a bit, but like the whole thing is that, yes, that's what they're saying, is that Walt is getting away with it, and it's starting to feel like that's what's supposed to happen. Like when he's at home there, that's the sort of the idea that I got from that, was that, like, you know, there were some big problems, but they solved them all, you know, and most of it came through his expertise and, you know, his chemistry background. And so he is kind of settling into at the end of this first season, that's sort of where the character's at, is that he's settling into this idea that, yeah, you know what, I can do this, I can pull it off. Nothing can stop me from making this happen.
Yeah, I mean, there have been several close calls, and yes, he's been able to think his way out of some of these problems. But I'm also thinking of, like, when Skyler almost catches Jesse moving the body, right? So there have been a couple of really, really close calls, and he keeps just getting away with things, and maybe he thinks of his luck as shifting as well, and who cares at this point? maybe.
Yeah. So a big shift in the production, switching over to using the methylamine. Is there anything that we want to say about this other than it's a funny, funny situation that they have go down when they go to steal this? You want to add anything extra about that?
No, I think what the you mentioned this in when you were talking about your impressions, Pete, but I think this those things about the methylamine, him having his pork pie hat, the sunglasses, the meth being blue, all those elements, I think, help this feel more like a season finale because these are all like such important elements of the show going forward, defining characteristics mm-hmm. going forward. And just that scene when they're stealing the methylamine, it's comedic for all the reasons you already said, right? Like we watch them stealing it, wearing their stupid ski masks. And, you know, one of the funny things about it, like Jesse's like, you know, why would you get these? Like, you know, go to a different store if these are all they have, the little pom-pom on top. But I love that later they use the same ski masks when they kidnap Saul. So, you know, like I guess Jesse wasn't that bothered by them.
Yeah,
but it just adds a degree of comedy to it.
Yeah, I love that. He says, if this is all they had at that store, you're in the wrong place or whatever.
Yeah, I really go like somewhere else.
Yeah, and you know the blue stuff being there, the way that he was able to pull off. You know, I like the way that this is, they introduce it, but they don't really make a big deal about it. You know, it's just sort of like, yeah, it's blue, but whatever. That turns out to be like his trademark. The thing that sets his dope apart from everybody else's.
Classic Coke, as he calls it.
Yeah. And then you know, we kind of already touched on the idea of him choosing the junkyard and that being kind of funny, and kind of the iconic shot of him twirling the hat as he puts it on for the first time. It's also kind of subtle, you know, it's just thrown in there. They don't make a big deal about it. Funny, you know, the hat, you know, look, I don't know if we want to talk about the hat too much, but one of the things about the hat is that it's supposed to be like, you know, I guess, let me see what you think about this. Like when you see it, he puts on the sunglasses and he puts on the hat and it's supposed to make him look incognito. You think that's what he's saying? You know what I mean? Like whenever he bought the hat, like I need something that'll you know, my bald head won't stand out or something like that.
That's a good question. I don't know, but I guess what stood out to me in that scene is how both he and Jesse are wearing their sunglasses, and I mean, you could just be like it's a sunny day, they wanted protection, but I think that's the part where they're trying to disguise themselves a little bit because Jesse's scared out of his mind, right? About to come face to face with Tuco. And I think Walt also feels maybe a little bit safer hidden behind his glasses. So yeah, I mean, maybe that's part of it. I think it's
I just think like the hat is not exactly incognito at all. Like it stands out. No. It's like if you think about the history of TV and the way like everybody remembers that as the Heisenberg hat now, like it's iconic.
Yeah.
And I just think it's kind of funny that it seems like he was like, I just need a hat, you know, and something that will, you know, kind of make me forgettable. You know, people won't pay attention because they won't see the bald head. And actually, it kind of does the opposite, doesn't it?
Well, I was going to say, like, I see the glasses as maybe them trying to, you know, shield themselves a little bit, but I didn't get that impression from him that he was using the hat as a disguise. I think he's using mm-hmm. the hat as a costume, and he's using that as almost like as a object of power or like a talisman. Because again, this is something that these writers really love to do. We see this in Better Call Saul also with Jimmy's Marco ring and Kim's the stopper from the Sephiro Añejo. So these ideas of objects bestowing some sort of power, it's a type of costume, right? Like so they hold these objects, wear these objects, interact with these objects, and it's a way of like tapping into something else, to like this other identity that they have. And that's something that's again similar between all three of the characters I just mentioned. They have this duality. You have Walt Heisenberg, Jimmy Saul, Kim Giselle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like how they're able to, like a physical thing that they can touch, almost like a magic thing that helps them get into that character.
Yeah. Have you ever had a pork pie?
No.
The food, not the hat?
No. Mm-mm.
Of course, you've never had the hat because nobody wears the hats except for Walter White. But I did do a bit of a deep dive into the actual pies, and they don't sound all that appetizing, if I'm being honest.
Just even the name pork pie doesn't sound good.
No, it's not the catchiest name. I mean, you don't forget it. You hear it and you don't forget it, but it doesn't make you think, oh, that sounds delicious. You know, that sounds so fun.
Yeah, it sounds like something you would get at Mrs. Lovett's Pie Shop. From Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
Anyone gets the reference.
Uh-huh. So, I don't know what else we need to get into here about the episode proper.
Well, there was one other thing that did stand out to me.
Go ahead.
And I'd never noticed this before watching it for the podcast. And it's I don't know if you would call it like it's not a continuity error, but it's just something that I was like, wait a minute. So Jesse's trying to sell his house. And we learned from the beginning when Walt goes to see him and finds him in the RV and he says, you know, I had two dudes turned into like raspberry slush and flushed down my toilet. You know, I can't live in there. I can't take a proper dump in the place is what he says, is his reasoning. Uh-huh. So you get the idea that Jesse is the one who has put the house up for sale. And then he calls it off, you know, when they're down in the basement cooking. Oh, and that was another line.
You aren't going to see the basement, bitch.
yeah. And that's just like, let me just briefly mention this as well. So like at the very beginning of the episode, when we see the real estate agent taking that couple down into the basement and she's like, just imagine all the things you could do down there. And of course the subtext is we watch someone be killed. And then later in that episode, we're going to watch them make meth. Right. So imagine all the horrible, criminal, awful things that you can do in your basement. Or you can turn it into a rec room. But going back to what I was talking about with Jesse, so you get this idea that Jesse's the one that has put the house up for sale. But then later in the series, we learned that actually it's not his house at all. It was his aunt's house, right? But she passed away. And then I don't know if she left it to his mother or she didn't have a will and it just went to his mother, because Jesse seems to have like an idea that it should have gone to him, that she said it was going to go to him. But legally, his parents own it, right? It went to his mother. And that's how she's able to evict him and then try to sell the house. She puts it up on the market. So as I was watching this, I was like, how is he able to do this? Like, how is he able to actually get this house on the market? Like, wouldn't any realtor look into, make sure everything is above board, that they have like all the proper documentation?
I don't think it really makes sense. You brought this up yesterday when we were talking, and then I don't think it actually makes sense for the overall story. But I guess it doesn't really jump out at you unless you're doing what we're doing right now, though. I mean, it's not like you said, it's not really a continuity error. It's not that important, I guess, in the overall scheme of things.
Yeah, I mean, like if you're going to believe that fulminated mercury can blast out a wall, you know, there's some suspension of disbelief. And I guess like this is one of those things that you just look over. It's not important, but it was just something that never occurred to me before. I was like, wait a minute, could he do that?
It is. So another thing that you had mentioned, it is interesting that they do kind of, you know, in a roundabout way, they say that they did. I mean, we kind of knew it already, but it kind of confirms the fact that they disincorporated Crazy 8's body also. You know, because it said they flushed them both down the toilet. You never see that on screen, but that's what they did with his body.
Walt did, because when Jesse comes home,
it's after already he done. Took off, right.
Yeah, it's already done. He's already gone. So that's something Walt took care of all on his own. Okay, well, I think it's that time of the episode to talk about our favorite lines and our favorite shots. So, Pete, what was your favorite line from this one?
I mean, there's so many of them, it's really hard, and you could probably, you know, pick out a handful of them instead of just one. But I settled on, this is like a non-criminal's idea of a drug meet. And I don't know, I just thought this is so effective. It's like one of those things where if you were watching this episode and they never brought it up, this meeting at this place, you know, this crazy junkyard, it would have felt fine, right? It would have been like, yeah, that's what you do. You go to crazy out of the way places that where there's privacy. And when you, you know, when you're handing back and forth these giant bags of drugs and money or whatever, you know, but it, so, yeah. So I thought this was super effective in the way that it points out how absurd that is, like how there's actually a much better place, you know, something that's out in public where, you know, nothing weird can happen because there's too many people around or whatever. It just seemed like a really smart choice to not only have it in that place, but then also call it out and use that as a way to show just how inexperienced and how, you know, clueless in a way that Walt is.
Yeah. My favorite line from this one, as you said, there's so many great ones and there's so many quotable ones. Like when people quote the show or they make like memes or GIFs of the show, there are a couple that they use. So I wanted to do something with like one of the more fun lines. I had a couple of choices, of course, like Tuco going tight, 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 even popcorners during the Super Bowl, like, you know, took that line. But I had to go with yes, science from Jesse. Mm-hmm. And just because I love that moment so much. And as far as favorite shot goes, what was your pick?
You know, I was going to use the one where Walt puts the hat on for the first time, the way that he twirls it there, because I think it's kind of interesting to think about him practicing that twirl in you know, his room by himself when no one's around. But and it's one of those things that's like, it's a great shot because it's, again, it's somewhat restrained. Like it doesn't make a big deal about it. There's not a big, you know, like a big, you know, something going on with the score or anything else. It's just sort of like a thing that happens, but it's such an important part of the visual language of the show and kind of the, you know, the way that it fits into the overall history of TV kind of thing. But I landed on Skyler handing Walt the orange juice in that scene when he comes home from the sweat lodge. And I thought that it was, one of those shots, like you're watching, you know, the focus is on Walt in the beginning. So you're thinking about where he's at, like what his headspace is. And then, you know, they show the orange juice come in. And the way that he, you know, he touches her hand, like it's all purely visual. Like the, you know, it's a natural progression of like you're wondering what he's thinking, and then you see her come in, and you don't see her, you just see her hand, and you see the way that he interacts with her hand, and I just thought that was like a super cool little shot that sets up one of the, you know, one of the final, like, really nice kind of domestic situations that they have, you know?
It is. And I mean, that the episode really, I mean, certainly we see the intimacy of them in the beginning, and then that's more raw, more animalistic, if you will. And then this is a much tender gesture. And to your point, yeah, it's like one of the final moments we're going to see of this couple really being a couple and really being happy. And
yeah, there's not a lot going on. Like it's not like something that, like, you know, overwhelms you, but it says so much, and some of it you don't really put together until later on, you know, like whenever you realize like just how bad things are going to get for them. So
yeah,
it's a really nice note for them, like, you know, like a emotional note for the relationship, I guess.
Yeah. It's a height note for Walt in every regard up till really the end. Like everything is starting to go his way. It's starting to fall in place. Things are good on the home front. He's made this deal with Tuco, so he's looking at all this money coming in. But as the title of the episode lets us know, if you caught the reference while you, like, before you watched the episode, you know it's not going to, you know, end the way that he expects it to. There's going to be consequences. There will be violence. Yeah, so.
Yeah, so what about you? What was your favorite shot?
My pick for this one is after they steal the methylamine, and then you get that shot of the porta potties. You have the two porta potties there and the little golf cart, and the poor security guard is locked inside. They've tied it off. And then they come waddling into frame wearing their ski masks, holding this very heavy barrel of methylamine. So just a little bit of a comedy there. I love that scene. And as you noted, it's a scene we'll see again on security cam in a future episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it is good. It's one of those things that I think, like, it feels like this stuff all happens later in the series in some ways. You know, this it feels like it felt a little bit surprising that whenever I thought about the structure of the first season that we're at this point already, you know, like where they're already into the P2P cook. But I think it's pretty natural, you know, it all happens pretty natural inside of what we watched unfold, because, you know, we did just get to the first, the end of the first season, which was just pretty exciting. I mean, is there anything that you want to, before we go, is there anything you want to get into about this experience of going through the entire season?
Well, I think I already mentioned this earlier, you know, watching it this closely and really taking time to digest what we're watching and thinking about it in terms of where we know it's going and in the larger story of this whole universe that also includes El Camino and Better Call Saul, I certainly felt differently about the characters. I still very much enjoyed the ride, but not as much as I think the first few times, like the first few go-throughs, right? Like it's still a great show. I still love it and everything, but I'm being more critical of it. And perhaps that's like a natural reaction to it. Like I'm really trying to delve into these characters' psyches and look at what's making them tick and everything. So it's a different experience, but I think that, again, like I'm surprised at how much they're able to accomplish in just 7 episodes. But as you talk about in that great video you made about why the pilot still rules, which you can go watch on YouTube, and you should if you haven't seen it. You talk about how, like, just even that first episode, the pilot, how it is like a mini movie unto itself. So that is one of the, I think, that the real talents of the writers of this show is how much story they're able to tell in a finite amount of time. And, you know, not a second is wasted. Every second that of storytelling counts and means something, except for maybe the fly episode, which I like, but we'll argue about that later.
Yeah. I think it, to what you were saying about the way you feel about it, I don't know. I think maybe the last time I rewatched it, I already experienced that different, different looking at especially like Walt's decisions in a different light. So it's not that isn't really necessarily jumping out to me as much. It's just, I think that some of the way that they crafted some of this stuff that I guess maybe I'm just seeing some more of it at this point that didn't jump out to me the last time, I don't know how many times I've watched individual episodes. You know, I can kind of figure out how many times I went through the whole thing, but like, it's still, for me, it still holds up pretty well. I mean, I'm experiencing it in a different way each time, and that's a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing, right? Like it's like peeling layers off the onion or something like that.
Yeah, agreed. And I guess one other thing that's different is having just come off of Saul, I'm seeing a lot more of like connections between them and parallels between them as well. So one thing that, for example, just briefly that stood out to me in this episode, when Walt and Jesse are talking about how much more, you know, meth they have to make, how much more money he needs to make. He doesn't have a figure in this one. We'll see that in the next season, you know, $737,000, whatever it is, the figure is. But here he just says more, right? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how much the delivery of that line, the way it's, the way he delivers it reminds me of a moment in Better Call Saul when Kim goes to interview with Schweikhardt and Coakley, and yeah, she's telling this story. Yeah, she's telling the story of how she left her little town in Nebraska, and that she wanted that she, well, I forget how they phrased it, but they asked her what she wanted and she just said more. And the delivery is so similar. And I was thinking between these two characters, more is never enough, is it? And we see that they're very different. I don't mean to compare Kim and Walt, although that could be a different conversation, right? Because there's some similarities. And also certainly with Jimmy and or slash Saul Goodman. But this idea of like not being satisfied and wanting more and taking things too far, I think is something that both shows explore. And so I don't know about you, but as I'm watching this, I keep making these connections. I'm like, oh, that reminds me of this, or this reminds me of that. I'm making a lot more intertextual references between the two series going back through it, which is natural, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. That was one of the things that we were curious about going in. And I will say that for sure it does. I mean, it's going to be even more obviously later when we start to see the Saul Goodman character and we see some of that stuff. But it's already been a big difference as far as how I think about the series as a whole and as now part of a bigger, you know, both of those two things together as a bigger universe. So it's really cool. I'm really enjoying it. I'm having a lot of fun talking about it with you. I'm glad we decided to do this. I'm glad people are starting to listen. If you enjoyed this episode, you should please follow our podcast and, you know, set up notifications so you know when the new episodes come out. And it would be great if you could rate and review us wherever you listen, because, you know, that makes other people maybe get to see it or listen to it. And that's all a big help.
Yeah, absolutely. And those who wish to support Growth Decay Transformation may do so by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/growthdecaytransformation. And I just wanted to give a quick little shout out to our newest patrons, Yazin and Crony24. Thank you so much for your support. We really, really appreciate it. And we encourage anyone else who would like to support to look into that, to join our Patreon. Some perks there for you, like early access to some episodes and some other things maybe in the future. You can connect with us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT and write to us at BreakingBadGDT@gmail.com. Thank you to all of you who have written to us and shared your thoughts and comments and suggestions. And to those of you who have left reviews on things like iTunes and Spotify, we really, really appreciate it. And as always, you can find our producer Talitha's Instagram at Talitha Makes Things. Thank you, Talitha. You are a great editor. And thank you all so much for listening. And we'll catch up with you for the season 2 premiere.
See ya.